Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Get off my world.
I'm Pat.
And I'm Josh.
And I'm Kelvin.
And this is Get Off My World. We are three fans who love the classic Doctor Who series and who are trying our best to love the new series too. Each show will struggle to come to terms with things like
Riversong,
instantly dated pop culture references,
and all 42 minutes of Robot of Sherwood. But we'll also talk our way through a number of other topics, which we're calling Five Rounds Rapid. Since this is the very first episode, we'll explain these as we go. Starting with round one, temporal grace.
Oh.
As we mentioned, we're fans who can get a little curmudgeonly when it comes to new Doctor Who, so we decided to start each podcast with something we're happy about in the world of Doctor Who. And I think for our very first episode, this has to be Peter Capaldi, right?
Yeah.
Peter Capaldi.
All right. So this episode is probably going to go out a few months from now, but right as we're speaking, the first five episodes have been broadcast.
First five, yeah.
Yeah. So the last one was Time Heist.
Time Heist. So Peter could still blow it. But right now, we love him.
I
what issues I've had have nothing to do with him. I like the crabbier sort of Doctor. I like the return of the impatience with dumber people, which is kind of the rest of the universe.
They've talked...
When you get right down to it.
Yeah, and I think the press talked a lot about the darkness of what Peter Capaldi could bring to it. And we've seen a little bit of that so far. They did that at the end of Deep Breath.
Mm-hmm.
He's talking to the creature thing before he tosses him out the door or whatever happens there. And into the Dalek, too, especially in his mind meld with the Dalek.
Mm-hmm.
But so far, I don't think they've gone too overboard.
No, I mean, they are certainly keeping him still likable. He's charming. He's dapper. But he has an intensity, and I think because the new series has wanted to do the burdened, darkened Doctor, but they've also wanted to do young actors in the role, and I think it works best for me when there's that age, and there's just something, no matter how good an actor you are, that life experience bring that, and a lined, craggy face. So,
yeah, and we'll talk about this probably later when we discuss Day of the Doctor, but his eyes in Day of the Doctor
yeah.
are pretty much the best part of that whole episode, which I love. I love the entire thing, but he stole it with 1 second of whoosh, zooming in on his eyes.
Yeah, and I think we've had lots of funny Doctors, and I think Capaldi's still funny, but he goes against the lines a lot. So they're very deadpan when he delivers them. So if he has a joke, it's very dry,
yeah.
and he drops it and walks away. He's not going to, I mean, it was fun to watch Matt Smith twirl around and jump up and down and wave
oh, yeah.
his hands and just make hay out of every line. But it's very fun to have that understated, dry, sardonic, sarcastic Doctor.
I'm loving it. I've said for years that I wanted an older Doctor. And yeah. he fits that bill completely. He's as old as William Hartnell was, or I think actually a little bit older from the filming of his first
He might
episode.
Be older by like a couple months or
right.
something. Yeah,
yeah. So that's checked a box for me that any actor of a certain age would have done.
It is kind of fascinating that they go from the youngest actor to play the Doctor to the oldest actor to play the Doctor.
But it's great. It shows a lot of versatility.
Yeah, you know, and that's Time Lords. You know,
and
might
know,
regenerate into a baby one day.
Oh, I'd pay to see that.
We've said we're a little curmudgeonly, and I haven't always been a huge fan of some of the younger interpretations and the flirtatious interpretation of the Doctor. But it's funny because now seeing this older, crankier Doctor who's not interested in chasing young ladies. It kind of retroactively makes me enjoy the Tennant and Smith interpretations better to see them as
yeah. Yeah.
regenerations as opposed to watching them as if, okay, this is what Doctor Who's always going to be like now. To see that variety, so even if they go back to that, it feels more like Doctor Who.
It seemed more almost like a marketing move at the time for me. You know, like...
It may well have been something of that. I totally agree with what Josh is saying. I didn't particularly care for that younger flirty interpretation either, but now that those are points on a spectrum of what new Doctor Who can be, I'm much more at ease with it.
Yeah, I didn't mind it. It took a while for me to get used to it, maybe, but I didn't really mind it.
Yeah, I just wonder if he's never going to have a romantic interest.
Okay, so now I feel that we are passing out of our state of temporal grace.
Yeah, and I'm feeling curmudgeonly.
All right, yeah, I can see, the viewers can't see it, but I can see that look coming on your face, Josh.
So now we're ready for round two, what we're calling Special Topics Dalek. In this round, one of the three of us will toss out a topic for the other of us to discuss. The other two won't know what the topic is ahead of time, so we'll have that extra spontaneous neeness, as one of the new doctors might say. And tonight, it's going to be Pat.
All right. So my special topic, Dalek, today is the question, what is your favorite thing that Russell Davies brought to Doctor Who? We can be curmudgeonly about Russell Davies often.
Yeah.
But let's remain in a state of temporal grace here for a moment. What is our favorite?
Well, I'd have to say I think one of the best moments he's pulled off is really that very first introduction of the Ninth Doctor.
Yeah.
When he meets Rose and says, "Nice to meet you," run, essentially. That's that moment where I went, this could work. Mm-hmm.
I would agree with that. Boy, what else?
You gotta dig deep, don't you, Calvin?
I kind of do. I'm trying to separate him from as like a showrunner and just as a writer, because it's like his writing was kind of the thing that I could get kind of problematical with at times.
Yeah.
They kind of went maybe too far with it sometimes for me, but I do like the idea of actually acknowledging that the Doctor has experienced a lot of terrible things in the hundreds of years that he's lived.
So you like the post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Yeah, I do think that was a perfectly legitimate thing to do. I mean, sometimes it got a little too weepy. You know, Davies was really into hitting these big emotional notes, and there were times when I kind of wanted it a little more...
quiet?
Yeah, I'm more
understated.
More of an adventure and less of a soap opera, maybe.
Yeah.
But no, I mean that needed to be acknowledged, I think, and I thought it was really.
Well, I think some of the problems is when it became formulaic. I think there's a lot of great ideas. I think the Doctor being thrown in a domestic situation, even like Rose, where he visited the family, and that was stuff we hadn't seen before, and it was actually quite funny, particularly the Ninth Doctor and his very gruff exterior and leather jacket and being slapped by mothers and being dragged into family dinners had a lot of humor and interest to it. But when it became that every Doctor had to go visit every companion's family,
Well, and that played to Russell Davies' strengths, too. He's good at ensemble dramas, a mixture of comedy and drama.
Yeah.
And to bring the Doctor into that situation was something, we'd never seen before.
I guess that was, something to mention is I liked that he acknowledged just sort of the okayness is a really terrible word to use, but the value of just sort of ordinary regular people.
And that's an attitude that was drawn in large part from the Virgin novels, where there was a lot of that Paul Cornell-ish attitude specifically, where the value of ordinary things.
Well, that was kind of the cool thing about Rose, you know, was she was literally like an extremely ordinary London girl.
Right.
And that was kind of nice in a way.
Yeah, and then they just struggled to replace that quality without repeating it
yeah.
endlessly. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think a lot of his initial instincts were really strong.
Yeah, and so to answer my own question, yeah. but going from what you've just said, the thing that I've always been grateful to Russell Davies for is that he kept the new series in continuity with the old, which it could have been so
yeah. oh,
easy.
Oh, I was so worried that was going to happen.
Yeah, it could have been so simple. And why yeah. wouldn't you just reboot the entire thing? You know, then you can explain everything new.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't do that. Up to and including Paul McGann and even obscurely drawing on elements of stuff from the books or Big Finish business. Yeah, it's all, it can all still be seen as part of one
universe. Especially when you consider that Doctor Who has reboots kind of built into the whole concept of it.
Right.
You know, like, oh, here's another time cataclysm thing that the Time Lords did. From a billion years
broke
ago.
Broke a universe off from the old one.
Yeah.
Like what they did with the Star Trek films.
Yeah, yeah, they essentially yeah. easily could have done that.
Yeah.
And made it. And, you know, they kind of did in that you can with the Time War, if you are not interested in the old series or not that interested in the new one, you can kind of just go, that Time War is that delineation, and this is kind of a new version. This is the old version. But also, if you like it all, you can easily integrate it.
Yep. Because there aren't so many specific continuity references that you get tangled up in it. Everybody knows the Daleks and the Cybermen, and so when those show up in yep. the new series, and we're talking about the Russell Davies episodes here, then it makes sense without getting, oh, you had to have seen Terror of the Zygons to understand what we're talking about now.
And the Time War does provide that great get out of jail card for the sporadic continuity of the old series. If something doesn't make sense, it's because of the Time War.
Right.
So it's a nice touch.
So there's Russell Davies.
Yeah.
What else do we love about him?
I didn't think I liked that much about him.
Yeah.
I'm being more positive than I ever have been.
My favorite ever. Stories from the Russell Davies era were the ones that were not written by Russell Davies.
Yeah. Adapted.
With the possible exception of Midnight. I liked Midnight a lot.
That's a good one.
Well, again, Midnight is Russell T. Davies being uncharacteristically small, which
I think was
always bothered me. Everything was
the biggest, the end of the universe, and biggest.
The stakes for someone who likes the mundane, small world details of domesticity, his narrative was always high stakes.
It's just like the there's time. Only so much you can go beyond the universe blowing up. You know? I mean,
reality.
How do you make
reality can blow up.
Yeah, you know, like
reality blowing up with more guest stars.
Yeah. Yeah, you work yourself into a weird corner with that, I think, you know, and
well, my thing on Russell Davies has always been that I like his first attempt at something a lot because I think he's had a lot of time to think about it.
Yeah.
So the best example is Queer as Folk, right? Which was what of his I had known when mm-hmm. I had heard that he was taking over the new Doctor Who. And I loved Queer as Folk. I thought mm-hmm. it was terrific. And then Queer as Folk 2 is dismal.
Mm-hmm.
It's much worse than most of the stuff
okay.
that he brought in later
I've never
seasons
seen
of
either
Doctor
either
Who. Series. Oh,
yeah,
we'll
the first
totally
series is
it.
Very, it's just super cohesive. It's
uh-huh.
Yeah, a lot
strong
of things
characters,
the second series isn't.
Great writing, and then the second thing is just a pale shadow of the first series, and I kind of started to feel that when David Tennant took over Doctor Who. I liked, for the most part, I really liked the Chris Eccleston series, and then almost immediately started to turn against it when David Tennant came. And it wasn't because of his performance, but it was because I was seeing a sort of self-satisfaction, a kind of smugness to the yep. show that wasn't there before.
Well,
yeah.
I think definitely with the Ninth Doctor, the portrayal often went against, he would act against some of the lines that were not as strong or weren't to my taste. He added a darkness, a smaller tone to some of the bigger dramatic stuff that Russell T. Davies put in. That Tennant, I think he's a good actor. I've liked him a lot of other things, but he would go big on everything. And again, it goes back to, I think, what we were saying about Peter Capaldi. If you're going to do the pathos and the dark doctor, Eccleston was able to pull that off. He could just stand still, and you could look into his eyes, and you're like, okay, he's shouldered a lot. Whereas Tennant, I think, was so young, and it's not that's not the kind of performance that I think is his strength. So as they made him more and more emo, it made the Doctor feel more childish, because I don't think he could pull it off.
It didn't really come off like tragedy. It just came off like sad puppy dogs. And I think I like the 10th Doctor era a lot more than either of you two do. But I don't disagree with you either. I guess is what I'm trying to say. But yeah, I just really wish... I really wish we could have gotten one more season of the 9th Doctor, though.
Yeah, he never embraced the flirting. It was kind of there, but it always felt like maybe your dad, who just got divorced, and he's maybe kind of just trying because he feels he should. And it has this, I don't want to say sad. It feels like you're introducing the idea of romance to a Doctor who's never tried it out.
Right.
I feel like he played it tentatively in an appealing way.
Yeah, is he...
And the 10th Doctor was just like, bring it, ladies.
Well, is it, you know, again, I don't know if how much of that is just genuine sexual interest on the Doctor's part and how much of it is just...
alien play acting?
Yeah, you know, being...
Or being a creep?
Well, you know, just sort of like weird enthusiasms.
They,
you know, getting all way into something and just being kind of an eccentric weirdo. Because I the Doctor isn't necessarily the most socially skilled character in science fiction,
right?
In any of his incarnations,
but in the Russell T. Davies era, they made him smooth, and everyone instantly loved him. I think you're right. In the older series, and even with Eccleston a bit, he would save the world, he'd help the rebels, everything would be great. They'd love him, but they'd kind of be happy to see him go. They weren't making him their, you know, messianic figure.
They weren't applauding him like in Planet of the Dead.
Pray to him, or, you know, there is that messianic thing that really takes over, especially with David Tennant, where everyone who meets him falls in love. And I always, what appealed to me as a kid was that Doctor who sometimes behaved very childishly, and like I said, who was kind of annoying and often had to be corrected by his companions. And there's definitely moments of that in Tennant. But that's something that's continued even to Stephen Moffat, not as much, but it is that the Doctor as the hero that everyone just loves at first sight.
Yeah.
And I think it's that meta fan thing, as they're projecting our feelings about the show and how much we like it onto the actual character and the narrative universe he inhabits.
You're not wrong. That's very much it. As the show became more confident, there was much more self-love involved with it.
Yeah. And
for me, the moment was right at the regeneration, because practically within the first episode or two of David Tennant, as the relationship between the Doctor and Rose became more age-appropriate, became smug immediately, right? It's like, yeah, we're the popular kids who are going around.
You know, I mean, I'm not crazy about the like super smug, like hyper confident sort of Doctor. And I didn't really like it either in the original series when...
John Pertwee was pretty much a dick.
He had some swagger.
I was thinking more like the 6th and 7th. The sort of hyper competent Doctor,
right?
And definitely, you had the 7th Doctor as superhero and who could do everything. Yet you didn't have within the narrative everyone recognize that. It was the opposite. They underestimated him and thought he was an idiot and he was a fool. And so you were missing out on that. And I think that's essential to the Doctor, for people to kind of think he's a...
They do get crazy way man. More in the new series about like this legend of the Doctor.
Yeah.
And like in the 11th Doctor era, when he decides, like, you know what, I've gotten too well known, I have to do something about that.
Yeah, he erases himself from all the databases.
And I'm like, yeah, okay. Yeah.
That sounds good.
Yeah, that was like, that had to have been done.
That's part of Moffat's wider project of erasing the parts of Russell Davies that he doesn't like. Right?
It's like every episode there is some small retcon of what he doesn't like about the previous.
I mean, we know the Doctor's awesome. We don't have to have like every alien race saying it.
Yeah, and there's certainly less of that in the Moffat era. There's a little of it here and there, but for the most part, that's been quieted, yes, at the very least. But this is supposed to be what we like about Russell T. Davies.
It's true. So let's.
But I think the general consensus would be that that first season and what he tried to bring to the show in the Ninth Doctor's first season, at least for the three of us, hit really well.
Some of my favorite Doctor Who moments are part of the new series, and that wouldn't have happened if Russell T. Davies hadn't happened.
Yeah.
So thank you, Russell, I guess.
Round 3, the randomizer. Normally each week we will randomly choose one adventure from the classic series and discuss it the following week. However, for our first 3 episodes, we're each going to discuss the classic adventure that introduced each of us to the series. So this week we'll be discussing Pat's introduction to Doctor Who, which is The Ark in Space.
That's right, Kelvin. The Ark in Space was more or less my first introduction to Doctor Who. I'd actually caught the fourth episode of Robot.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because we were all about the same age, so we remember when Doctor Who was broadcast on public television. Yeah. It's Channel 2 here in the Twin Cities.
I think that's where we all watched it.
Yep.
Yeah.
And so I've been racking my brain to try to figure out exactly what year this was. It must have been somewhere between 1980 and 1982 when they started showing the Tom Baker episodes starting from Robot, mm-hmm, on PBS in afternoons on weekdays. Mm-hmm. And so I could come home after school and I could watch them. And I must have known something about it before from TV Guide or the inserts that came in the daily newspapers. And I think I may have even seen Doctor Who books at Walden Books, because I was a science fiction nerd even, mm-hmm, at that age. I'd read superhero comics and whatever else I could get my hands on.
Does Walden Books even exist anymore?
Oh, I'm sure it doesn't. No. Yeah, no, I mean,
Walden Books in a long time.
There are no bookstores anymore.
Yeah.
But in the day, there were bookstores. And so anyway, I'd heard about Doctor Who.
You'd have to go into
a
store and there'd be these things made out of paper. And you'd read them.
Yeah.
There used to be public television. There's still public television.
There's still public television.
For now.
For now, for the moment, there's still public television. I'd seen episode 4 of Robot, but for the purposes of this podcast, we're going to call The Ark in Space my first introduction to it, which is emotionally satisfying because it was the first thing that really grabbed me.
And it's one of the really good episodes.
It's really good.
I think of the original series.
It's Robert Holmes.
Yeah.
I didn't know that at the time. I didn't know anything about the writers. And looking at it again, well, first let me say what appealed to me about it. First, I didn't understand what the heck was going on at all. At first, they were on Earth, and there were these army people, and that's fine. I'm like, well, okay. But now, all of a sudden, we're in the far future, and I could grasp the plot quickly enough. Oh, okay, the Earth has been destroyed. There's these people on an ark. But there was something about the tone and the attitude of the show that it was something I had never seen before. It was quiet. There's a small cast of characters. It's intimate in an odd way, and the electrifying personality of Tom Baker is so strange,
mm-hmm,
very, mm-hmm, strange. He's got his two companions who seem almost as bewildered as I am, and I just don't understand a lot of the what's going on. What's the blue box?
Yeah.
Who is this person? Why are they here? How did they get here? Right. And so while
I
could
same questions you ask God.
Right.
Why am I here? What's going on?
As a tormented Catholic boy. Well, I wasn't tormented yet, but okay. So I practiced my tormented Catholicism on Doctor Who. Then we'll call it that. But so I could. Right, so I could follow the plot, but I didn't know the wider context. I didn't know what the heck was going on. So, and that was so fascinating to me.
Yeah.
And that was why I fell in love with the show and continued with it with some interruptions ever since. Now, years later, and we're revisiting Ark in Space for this podcast.
And you know, this was the second episode or story that I ever saw of Doctor Who. And honestly, as a young kid, maybe about 12, it did not capture me or capture my attention as much. Mm-hmm. And it's one that in revisiting, I really like it now.
Yeah.
And I think because obviously it doesn't have spectacular special effects. This is not, it's not one of their strong special effects stories.
No.
Although it does have a strong set.
It does. It has a great set.
It's a really
set,
good set, yeah.
Very strong set. And I think, you know, the whiz-bang of it is not necessarily always there. But rewatching it with old eyes, the script is really good. It is really, I mean, it's a serial program, and sometimes the serials could get really repetitive. But the first thing I noticed in this rewatch is Holmes has this thing really well structured. Mm-hmm. The how the information is released in each episode, there's very little repetition. There's very little capture-escape type of stuff that mm-hmm. is sometimes the problematic thing in serialized adventure. And Doctor Who is not free from that. But yeah, I thought it was really an impressive script. It's super witty. I started writing down my favorite lines, and then I started writing down like every line that was spoken, particularly out of Harry. Like everything Harry says.
God, I
is
love Harry.
Just
yeah.
Harry's one of the most underrated companions. I like that he was just kind of this bloke.
Oh, yeah. My favorite line is probably, I'm no regressive, I'm a naval officer. Because it's said with such earnest, straight-faced quality that is
I can catch some of
awesome.
The satire now that I never could when I was 9 or 10 years old.
Oh, yeah.
So even at the time, he was supposed to be something of a buffoon. Like a lovable, old-school, sexist buffoon.
Yeah, to contrast with what they were trying to do is this super feminist character of Sarah Jane.
I think one of the things, well, revisiting it recently, one of the things that struck me, it's a really small story in one sense, but it's really big in another sense of, you know, it's theoretically the fate of the human race. Because, mm-hmm. you know, how much, we don't really know at this point how much of humanity survived this solar flare.
And we only see like 4 of them.
And we only see like 4 people and all the rest of them are frozen. And they're being used as incubators for these space bug things. And yeah. But it's still really small in scale. You know, there's like 5-6 characters in it.
And for the very first episode, there are none except the regular TARDIS cast yeah. and the computer voice, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, that was the other thing. The first episode is literally, you know, in one sense, nothing really happens. It's just the Doctor and Sarah and Harry kind of like looking through the space station, you know, where are we? What is this place? What, you know, what's going on? But it never seems slow.
But it is never a mystery. They're filling in. Because sometimes yeah. that happens and you as the viewer know what's going on, so it's boring. Because the characters have to figure it out, but you know. But in that first episode, you have no idea where they've landed.
Yeah.
And so even though it's just the regular cast and there's nobody else, it's very intriguing. And they put each piece of the puzzle together and they drop the information. It's really well paced.
Yeah.
And I like that the Doctor, you know, solves some problems by just sort of, you know, commonsensical things. You know, he doesn't do like some weird pseudoscience thing or zap it with the sonic screwdriver. I mean, literally, they get around that defense mechanism thing by hiding under a table.
Because he's a real boffin, as Harry.
Yeah. And then, you know, like, throwing, you know, his hat is on a stick to, like, see, like, what the
yes,
mechanism will
really,
respond to.
Really embrace that anachronistic thing. Like, even when in the opening yeah. scene when they come out of the TARDIS, they've got a flashlight and an oil lamp.
Yeah.
And they've just grabbed whatever random junk, and he uses the yo-yo as the gravity detector. And Holmes is really embracing that whole idea of him kind of using just random objects and what is at hand to do scientific-y
yeah, things. Yeah, I kind of wish the newer series would have the Doctor doing some just random little.
Well, because they made the sonic screwdriver the magic wand, so he doesn't have to do those fun little things.
Yeah, but
the other thing Robert Holmes does really well in this is, and he always does really well, is where he can get, you know, he's making a social commentary or a social observation. Mm-hmm. On one hand, but then it also provides just some classic stupid comedy at the same time. The whole thing with the guys who have been chosen to further the human race. They talk about genetic purity, and they talk about regressives, and that there's been some maybe kind of scary genetic stuff going on to make sure the race is pure. And
they're all white people.
Yep, they're all white people.
They're all really English.
They're all English.
Like academic emotionalist.
And that's the thing. So then out of that is some actual commentary. But then he also, because of that, gets them to act like very stiff, classically portrayed futuristic science fiction people. They speak in high diction and they talk about regressives. And you know it's intentional on his part, because then they're really confused by everything that Harry says. Makes no sense to them. And so he gets also this kind of shallow but great fun kind of comedy between Harry bumping up against the characters in a way that they don't quite understand what he's talking about. There's one great line where they're realizing that things are going wrong in the space station, and Harry says, "Gremlins could get into anything. First law of the sea." And one of these guys just turns and stares at him in this kind of Oliver Hardy sort of way, and they cut away. Like, who are you?
One anecdote I would like to just kind of throughout here.
No anecdotes in this podcast. I don't think this is a place for anecdotes.
Sure. Who do you think you are, Calvin?
But my friend Melissa Kircher.
Oh, name dropping too. Yeah. And anecdotes.
Who also has a podcast with Wendy Bowlesby called Xanadu Cinema Pleasure Dome. It's really good. You should listen to that too.
I'm cutting that out.
Plug.
Okay, fine. She apparently, like, when she was a kid, was too scared of Doctor Who to be able to watch it. But she wanted to watch, like, I think it was Monty Python that followed Doctor Who. So she would sometimes see little bits of Doctor Who doing the classic hiding behind the sofa kind of thing. And she said, like, there's this... So she doesn't really know Doctor Who super well. And she's trying to describe this one thing she saw that super scared her. It's like this guy and his hand was turning into, like, a green, pulpy, slimy thing. And me and Michael Lee and like a couple other people. I think I've heard this story repeated so many times that I may have confused that I was there at the moment. But everyone just goes the Ark in space. Yeah. That's clearly the Ark in space.
Yeah.
It can't be any other episode but the Ark in space. I'm like, okay. And so finally, like years later, as an adult, she finally gets around to like just for her own curiosity, watching the Ark in space, and her reaction was like, "It's bubble wrap? I was scared of bubble wrap."
It's a testimony to the script, I think, and the performances. I don't know the actor's name off the top of my head, but the gentleman who plays Noah, he does a really good job. He's playing it big, because that's the style of this, but it is still distressing. And I think, I don't know, I can't remember which episode, if it's two or three, but the woman's voice is activated, the woman from Earth from thousands and thousands of years ago who's giving them the big pep talk, the big...
And
they're cutting between everyone listening to this pep talk and Noah struggling with that bubble wrap hand and stuff. And the contrast between the aspirations for these people thousands of years ago when they set off and this horrible thing that has happened to them now is pretty strong. It's a really nice, the direction's really nice, and it's a nice bit of scripting.
Yeah. Something should be said, too, for the fact that we all watch these on a 12-inch, maybe black and white, maybe color, who knows what, television.
I remember Channel 2's reception being really not very good where I lived.
Yeah, you were probably standing there holding the antenna in place.
Yes, I was.
There were clouds above, you couldn't see. Yeah, so it seemed like your imagination could fill in or elide over some of the crummier little special effect details.
Like I said, the script has just got constant clever dialogue throughout. And this is typical Holmes, but like Rogan is... got a couple really funny lines. Who seems like just a throwaway character, and yes, he makes a grand sacrifice at the end. But he has this great small line about they're doing something and some equipment, and it's just a cutaway end of scene line where he's like, "We should have stayed on Earth. I like Earth. I like heat." He's talking about the solar flares, and it's just those small little things that make these people feel less generic. That Holmes was so.
He was always good at minor characters bitching at each other.
Yeah.
And this is a good script because he doesn't go into full black-hearted cynicism the way he will in Robert Holmes.
Yeah, I still like
really hopeful.
It does. Well, and the whole speech, the human race.
Yeah, the human race speech is great, yeah.
It's good stuff.
It's because he was younger. As we all know, we're aging, and we get darker and meaner.
Mm-hmm. Well, but even so, there's that Blake 7 episode that's only a few years after this.
Mm-hmm.
The villa weighs 45 kilos or whatever. Maybe I'm getting off topic, but that's like the darkest, blackest thing that Bob Holmes ever wrote, and that was only a few years after this. It's probably about contemporaneous with the Sunmakers, I'm guessing. That quality of darkness was in him from the beginning.
But. Yeah, this is morbid. There's body horror. It has a lot of the things that Holmes likes to do, but yeah, it is definitely got a uplifting ending. There's grand sacrifices and noble, virtuous deeds,
and the human race is worth dying for, even if
you're turning
into a bug thing, or you're a working class dude, right? Mm-hmm. Who, because that's Rogan, right, at the end, who sacrifices himself.
It's Rogan, and then Noah as well still holds on to the vestiges of humanity and kills all the
Wirin.
The Wirin, yep. And one last thing that struck me watching the Peter Capaldi episodes, and there has been so much to do about this is going to be a crankier, fiercer doctor. I love that the first line of this show is the fourth doctor yelling, "You're a clumsy, ham-fisted idiot," at Harry. And sometimes the memory cheats, and you forget that there were plenty of impatient, mean-spirited comments made by the doctor throughout.
Especially toward poor Harry.
Yeah, especially Harry. And I think the reason it's not too harsh is because Harry, it's just like water off a duck's back.
Right.
He's just like, yeah, I am.
Right, right. Yeah, it feels much more acceptable than the third doctor's occasional outbursts against Joe, which are kind of unpleasant.
Yeah, that does seem like you're snapping at a puppy.
So that's, you know, Ark in Space. That was my first introduction to Doctor Who.
Nice introduction.
All these years later, this is what got me going, right? This.
Yeah, I mean, it could have been Time in the Ronnie.
Could have been Time in the Ronnie, and then we wouldn't be sitting here right now.
So three thumbs up.
Oh, yeah.
For Ark in Space.
Yep.
Okay, now it's time for round four. Wonderful afunctionalism. This is the round where we get to try out various things that we don't necessarily want to do every episode. We might read mail from listeners, or we might discuss the latest episode of the new series or big Doctor Who news. We might put on our own Big Finish style audio drama. Who knows?
Very likely.
Very likely. For the first few episodes, we're going to do whatever comes to mind. So we've got a couple questions that we can discuss, and what about, let's say, Josh, Kelvin, what are your favorite Doctor Who epiphenomena? What kind of little bits and pieces of Doctor Who that most people don't know about? What do you just love? Are there underpants that you wear that have Tom Baker's face on them?
Okay.
That sort of thing.
Oh, Pat and his $5 words. What is he talking about? that's a good one.
I have one while Kelvin thinks.
Okay.
Please, Josh.
Years ago, and I didn't buy them, and maybe this is the internet, so maybe someone could tell me where to find them, on the Huna website, which is a great shopping site, someone had made a bunch of these crochet Doctor Who toilet paper cozies, and they were in the
you
form...
You just made that up.
No, I did not. They were in the form of the actual doctors. I remember that there was a Colin Baker one, and there was the master as well.
The master.
Yeah, so if you had two bathrooms...
Just like their heads?
Nope, it was their entire body, and their little crochet legs, that you could sit them on the toilet paper, covering it up, and their little legs might hang over the
Is this the Roger Delgado master, or...
You know, I think the crochet work was very good, but I couldn't tell.
Honestly. Okay.
No offense if this person who made them is listening. But it brought the best features of both masters together into one crochet toilet paper cozy. And I regret that I didn't get it. So if there's someone out there who can tell me where I can get these, because I really kind of want the Colin Baker one. And the master for the guest bathroom.
Oh, that's crazy.
You got something, Kelvin?
I thought of something. It's a t-shirt. Now I'm kind of notorious for having a large collection of t-shirts. And I probably would not get this particular Doctor Who t-shirt, but I was rather impressed when I saw it. It's all the doctors together and they're taking a selfie.
Oh, that's cute.
I just remember I can't remember it in detail offhand, but it was like all the doctors' personalities were evident in this. Like the one who was actually taking the selfie was the 10th.
Of course.
You knew damn well it would be the 10th that would do this, you know. And
he'll feel bad about it later and say he's sorry, so sorry.
Yeah, and then you know, but the 10th is taking the selfie and the other you know, like the doctors you think would be kind of mugging particularly big are the ones that are mugging particularly big, and the ones who are like, why are we doing this? Are the ones, you know, go with that sort of why are we doing this expression. And
nice.
But if I were to, the one Doctor Who t-shirt I've thought about getting and haven't gotten was the one with all the doctors in 8-bit art. Like their little old-time video game.
We'll get you that.
Okay.
We'll get you.
But yeah, the selfie t-shirt I thought was pretty cool.
That sounds adorable.
Yeah.
I'm going to Google it the moment we're done recording. So yeah, I guess for me, to get a little sentimental for the moment, when I was a kid, I had a Dalek pencil case. It had a zipper up the side. It was made out of vinyl. It wore off in patches all the time, and it looked like something dirty. No one in my class knew what it was. Nobody watched Doctor Who. I kept my pens and pencils in it, and it was adorable for everybody. Who was me? Loved it. That was my favorite bit of Doctor Who epiphenomena. Isn't that sweet?
Our families need to listen to this right before our birthdays.
Yes.
That's now they know.
That's right. Mom, I think you bought it for me at Uncle Hugo's once before. Can you do it again?
And now it's time for our fifth and final round, the Death Zone. In this round, we'll pair two different Doctor Who texts, televised story, audio adventure, prose, comic book, you name it, and see how they stack up against each other. This week, it's the Five Doctors versus the Day of the Doctor.
Woo! Day of the Doctor. Ouch. What else are we going to talk about?
Oh, wow. That's the victor?
Yeah.
In your mind? Hands down? I didn't think it would be hands down. This is a lot of hands wringing.
I have a tremendous childhood fondness for the Five Doctors because that was super exciting at the time when I saw it. It's like, oh my god, it's five doctors together, holy crap, you know, that it was a big thing. But you can tell looking back on it now that it was kind of rushed. Like you could tell the script was kind of, oh god, we're running out of time, we got to get five doctors together, and we don't have Tom Baker.
Podcast has been very amicable so far.
Yeah.
I would not say
that
the
Josh?
Script it's a tough call, I will say that. But yeah. I don't think the script is rushed. I rewatched Five Doctors yesterday, and it's another one where I started jotting down like the great lines, and it's Terrence Dicks, just like every line out of every character is a funny line, a knowing line, a very character-appropriate line.
Mm-hmm.
He understands these guys, like, particularly
doctors
that are actually
bad or anything. Jeez, no.
Alive really, really well. And it's very simple. It's very elegant. There is the glaring lack of Tom
Baker.
It's elegant.
It's elegant.
It's elegant. Yes.
And I did really like that the one that kind of solves everything is the first doctor.
But it's not. I mean, it's hard to look at some other old guy playing the first doctor.
That's the second of the two huge disappointments of the Five Doctor. The first is
because it's
Tom
the three doctors.
There. Yeah, and the second is that William Hartnell isn't there. There's nothing you can do about that. He's dead.
Yeah, it didn't bother me.
We could still be angry and bitter about it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so we can rage at the universe for it, but not at Terrence Dicks or the production team.
But yeah, even when you look back maybe I'm bringing too many other things into it. When you look back at the three doctors,
which I think is better.
Than the Five Doctors?
Than the Five Doctors.
Oh, man, this is a whole nother...
Okay. I don't know about that, but anyway.
We're not versing them. Maybe we should have done that one.
We'll put a pin in that.
Okay, William Hartnell's in that just barely because he was so ill that he could only show up on this video screen.
Yep.
But it was interesting to me, like, you know, the second and third Doctor don't get along at all.
And they carry that through from the
And they carry that through, which is cool. And then they bring... but the first Doctor shows up, and they suddenly stop arguing and seem to treat the first Doctor with an exaggerated amount of respect.
Which is weird. It's like if your 10-year-old self showed up and started giving you advice.
The youngest one would be the one
you know, the first one should have the most interesting viewpoint or something. And of course, what he first says is, so these are my replacements, a dandy and a clown. You know, like...
reading off a cue card, just barely.
Yeah. but yeah, I thought it was kind of interesting in the Three Doctors and the Five Doctors that the first Doctor is sort of the most respected one.
Yeah.
But we're not discussing the three
Doctors. I mean, in the Five, well, we are discussing the Five Doctors, and that's hard when you put the guy who's been recast as the sort of revered, respected character because you don't know him, and he does a great job with the cranky side of the first Doctor, but he doesn't have the light, lovable touch that William Hartnell also had in his portrayal. So there's kind of none of that. He's merely the gruff guy with a cane, which he captures really well.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, what I think I object to a lot in the Five Doctors, and I don't hate it, you know, but it's one of those things I've seen a million times, and so I feel like I could
see familiarity breeding contempt.
Yeah, it has so many people in it. It has to deal with not only the Doctors, even though we're down one, but all the companions too.
Yeah.
And some of it is terrific. Second Doctor and the Brigadier is great.
That brings a tear to my eye. Every line out of his mouth is both of their mouths in those scenes. It seems you can tell that Terrence Dix is just having the time of his life writing those scenes.
That's my favorite part of the Five Doctors, easily. Third Doctor and Sarah Jane, I like a lot as well. And I like the First Doctor and Tegan.
Which is a
strange combination that works pretty well, and it gives Richard Herndahl an opportunity to shine against someone who's other than Carol Ann Ford, which would have this extra layer of weirdness because it's not William Hartnell there. But the flip side of this is you stick Carol Ann Ford and Mark Strickson in the TARDIS while the Cybermen are like dumping bombs around it for a long time. They have nothing to do.
I think it should have been a spinoff.
Just hang it like a character drama.
You get lost in the TARDIS, and it's
I like the scene where like the first Doctor walks into the TARDIS expecting it to be his TARDIS, and it's not, and that's when he meets the fifth Doctor.
Yeah,
it is weird that they don't bring up anything. The weird Susan's weird in it, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Susan's very weird
because
they don't want to address that issue.
They don't want to address it. And at first, I'm watching it going, okay, this is pre. Nobody had videotapes. They don't want to open all that. They want these old actors there for anyone who remembers it faintly. we haven't been poring over the internet and the whole continuity. So that's what I kind of forgave it. But then we get up to the second Doctor with Jamie and Zoe, and then we bring up very old continuity with the War Games and their memory being erased. So then I'm like, well, wait, so that really can't excuse us not talking about the relationship between all these doctors seeing their granddaughter again, except for Peter Davison does a really great actor moment with a line.
They share a look.
They share a look, and he gives as much emotion to a nondescript line. I can't remember what it is. They're introducing each other, and this is Susan, like you'd have to introduce, and he says, of course, or something.
Yeah,
like
so like, yes,
but he imbues it with a lot of meaning.
It's like you're meeting your granddaughter after how many hundreds of years, and you're like, oh yes, of course,
after you abandoned her.
Yeah, and maybe that is just a hugely socially awkward.
You fell in love right after the Daleks invaded in the 22nd century, and you dumped me.
But it almost
left me. Yeah.
It almost feels like you could extrapolate, this is headcanon now, like that somehow in you don't know much about Time Lord society and regenerations. If somehow you know family members are really attached to a regeneration, and if it is like you die and it's this weird almost seeing like a ghost of,
you just don't talk about it.
Or there's
some missing episodes there that where all of this was resolved and everything's fine.
Yeah. We'll have to assume that. That is an odd.
But anyway, like getting back to the actual point of this discussion, I do prefer the Day of the Doctor. I think that I loved the Day of the Doctor. I thought it was great. I thought it hit those new series emotional notes really well. I thought it did a great job of bringing various aspects of the new series together and presenting them, and it had Zygons in it.
Well, yeah, I'm with you, son. I enjoyed a lot more than the Five Doctors, but I guess if you want to balance them off against each other, the Five Doctors is better at doctor-companion relationships, and Day of the Doctor is much better at doctor-doctor relationships,
yeah.
Of which there is almost none in the Five Doctors.
Yeah.
Not a lot of doctor-on-doctor action. No.
That is a spinoff I would hate to see.
Yes.
Now, having said all of that, I watched Day of the Doctor again yesterday, and once again, it broke my heart that Christopher Eccleston could not be in it.
Yeah, there is that mirrored thing with Tom Baker's. You feel his absence hugely, and you feel that. I mean, John Hurt is amazing.
Yeah, John Hurt is one of my favorite actors. I've loved him for years. I will never hear a word said against him, but it just isn't it so obvious that it was originally scripted.
That should have been the Ninth Doctor,
yeah.
Yeah, they retconned in the War Doctor stuff, which I think works fine.
Which I think is a great idea.
It's great. It's got John Hurt. All three of them are terrific together. But, oh my God, could it not have been Christopher Eccleston?
It would have been so satisfying. Yeah, so it is. There's a sadness there. I almost feel like they missed a beat not making some, if they even all three referenced the Ninth Doctor somehow, or if it was kind of like this solemn moment they all three knew. Well, I guess Hurt wouldn't, but 10 and 11 kind of didn't speak about themselves as the Ninth Doctor. They were so devastated, and almost some acknowledgement.
You're absolutely
there might have been nice.
Even more than the absence of the actor.
Yeah.
To not acknowledge his presence at all, except in the quick little thing when all of the doctors
couldn't
are there.
For some legal reason.
It's possible.
Moffat in an interview said he thought, at least to the question people asked, why didn't we see when the War Doctor regenerates? Why didn't we see an image of the Ninth Doctor? That he said it would be kind of. He said it would kind of be rude. Some guy said, "I don't want to be in it," and so you just use some old image and stick him in there against his will.
Yeah,
I think that makes sense. I see that as a respectful thing, but I think it also, even a throwaway line would have helped that whole.
You could, if you were not 100% familiar with the series, watch almost all of Day of the Doctor, not knowing that there was a ninth, a regeneration between the War Doctor and David.
And that might have been very intentional. They're just trying to get more and more people excited about, especially during the anniversary series, that's a jump-on point for people and might have been an intentional decision.
I did like that moment where they kind of address... I don't know if excesses is the right word, but like... some of the criticisms of the 10th Doctor era and the 11th Doctor era of the moment, saying it's the one who regrets and the one who forgets.
Yeah, there was some nice stuff, and I feel like they're kind of were priming the audience with John Hurt for Peter Capaldi.
Yeah.
An older Doctor, more traditionally, a little grumpier, someone who was criticizing and contrasting.
I wonder if they can think that far ahead, or plan that far ahead.
Oh, Moffat was. I mean, he had Peter Capaldi in it, his eyebrows. You
know? Oh, that's true.
So I think all the discussions...
But did they know it was going to be Peter Capaldi when they're writing this thing? I don't think Moffat knew that yet.
I mean, I could be wrong. I'm sure he was thinking of an older actor, some sort of contrast.
I think once they knew
that Chris Eccleston was not going to be in it, then I think they were looking for somebody like John Hurt right there.
Because then you already, if you've never seen him, you bring the affection you have for John Hurt to the screen in lieu of having an affection for an old actor you've previously seen.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think it's interesting. You're talking about Moffat retconning a lot of RTD stuff. On my second viewing of The Day of the Doctor, it is really, they are vicious to Doctor number 10. Yeah. I mean, most of the jabs and the jokes
timey-wimey.
Are all at the expense
Timey-wimey?
And some are funny, and some are just mean. Like, I missed the first time around. I mean, I'm all for it, because I wasn't always fond of Tennant's performance. But I missed it the first viewing of the 10th Doctor comments on the War Doctor's posh, gruffly voice. And 11 says, you know, brave words, Dick Van Dyke, making fun of comparing his Cockney accent, Tennant's, to... Dick Van Dyke's horrible horrible one. I mean, it's really buried, but I mean, that is exactly what it is. It's just an
Well, they keep calling him Sand Shoes.
Yeah.
I mean, there's one fun crack of 11, where 10 calls 11 Chinny.
Yeah. They make fun of 11, too, but I mean, they really single him out. They make fun of his going away line.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I don't want to go. And that's clearly just like making fun of how wimpy and stupid that was. Maybe I'm projecting onto that. There's also the soliloquy joke that the 10th Doctor always did when he's telling the rabbit in the forest that he's the last time.
Oh,
I think, yes. No, it's great, but great. I thought it was hilarious.
When I am the oncoming storm, oh, you're just a rabbit.
Yeah, and I think it's very funny, but it seems like a disproportionate number of barbs are aimed at the 10th Doctor. And oddly, I liked him better than in his original run, because I think that's what his original run was missing, is those moments. The Doctor's constantly in the original series being deflated by people around him.
Yeah, you must be reading my mail, Josh, because I was exactly going to mention that. I wrote in my notes for Day of the Doctor, is this my favorite David Tennant episode?
Yes, I love him in
this. It probably isn't, you know, when I revisit them. I'm sure I'll find something others. But what I liked about his performance in Day of the Doctor is the relaxed quality to it. He was very at ease with Matt Smith and with John Hurt.
It's nice not to see him in this, like,
attitudinize.
No. It's nice not to see him in this outrageously in control.
Or so self-consciously tortured.
Thing. You know, and it's kind of too bad he didn't get more moments like that. But
he's a terrific actor. I've seen him in many other things that I think he's very good at. I've just never warmed to his portrayal as the Doctor, and maybe that's equal parts Russell Davies and David Tennant.
I tend to blame Russell Davies more than I blame David Tennant.
I mean, like Stephen Moffat's David Tennant episodes are my favorite episodes with him.
Oh yeah.
So I mean,
it's kind of the best of both worlds.
He dialed down the moralizing, because I think Tennant was the worst at the big grand moralizing speeches that just seem a little just hitting you over the head, and the Doctor's too full of himself, and none of that was present.
Yeah.
In this one.
Except with the rabbit.
Except for the rabbit, and it was hilarious.
Yeah.
And the rabbit was adorable. Good job, rabbit.
Nice.
Whoever cast the rabbit.
Nice awesome. Animal acting in the part of the rabbit.
So last thoughts on Day of the Doctor? I mean, well, we got to figure out which one wins here, boys.
Well, I'm going with Day of the Doctor.
Me and Kelvin Josh.
So hard.
Okay, make your case. Make your case. Convince us.
I don't have a case. I really don't. I love the Five
Doctors. I have a great fondness for the Five Doctors. As you know, it was a big moment for me as a kid, but I think Day of the Doctor is just a much
I can go with Day of the Doctor if I can invent one more little nitpick.
Please.
And that is, it's still a really great episode, but I would have loved to see a less mundane portrayal of the Time War.
Oh,
partly
yeah,
that's
terrible.
Russell T. It's Davies. Terrible. Partly it's that they released it in theaters and they wanted a Star Wars thing.
I assume that was just a budgetary thing.
Boring as
budget. It was great looking, but it was just. I even think they could have done the whole visual spectacular Star Wars-y laser battle, and just had them, when they went to like the war room, have some throwaway lines that suggested that there was weird type of warcraft going on that involved time. Russell Davies dropped those in all the time. Like,
I always found
weird, bizarre lines about what happened in the Time War.
I always found it kind of weird to see like Time Lord soldiers with guns.
Yeah,
I think they would have something more.
Yeah,
it's an awfully more conventional sort of war, isn't it? It's not like Alan Moore's
thing. Well, if you made a, you know, if you actually showed a war with, you know, the technology that a billion year old civilization would have, it wouldn't be recognizable.
No,
narratively, I think it was a choice on Moffat's part. I will give him credit for that, because I think the important part of the war story in there was the whole children, and did you count the children? And by showing a conventional style of warfare, we can relate to it and see kids in the middle of that. If you're talking about the Neverwhere man sucking in the time vortex and all the kind of lines that Russell T. Davies would throw out, it's abstract enough that thinking about children dying in it doesn't hit you.
No,
but when you see moms grabbing children and explosions, you go, oh, man.
Yeah, it's awfully goddamn kind of you, Josh. Yeah, that's, you know, give Moffat credit for that. Yeah, I don't agree. I thought it was a failure in plot logic. But having said that,
I'm saying I could see that as an argument for why he chose that.
Okay.
In 3D. What looks cooler in 3D? Laser battles.
I will dwell on this after the end of the podcast.
And then the little coda with Tom Baker showing up.
Oh, yes. Oh, very nice.
You know,
weirder than ever.
Weirder than ever, and bringing in that adding some more mystery to the Doctor again. Like, why is there suddenly an older fourth Doctor?
I did like that a lot. It was well done. It was well written. It was small. Tom Baker was weird, but he was still small weird. You know, he wasn't literally chewing the scenery, so it was everything you loved about the best of Tom Baker. And Matt Smith was a gentleman. He just supported Tom Baker. It was all about Tom Baker. He didn't in any way try to compete.
You know, it's like why is there some sort of old reflection of the fourth Doctor that's curating this museum? And you kind of hint at it, but he doesn't.
Yep.
You know, and just the whole thing about no. The name of the painting is Gallifrey Falls No More.
So my thought is, since we see, you know, Tom Baker was the missing thing in the Five Doctors, but we get the delayed satisfaction of the 50th anniversary. Maybe for the 75th, we'll get ancient Christopher Eccleston come hobbling out and say some crazy stuff.
We should live so long.
By the time we get to like the 28th Doctor, you know, he's probably just like an ionized cloud of gas or something, some way out there future concept.
Fine, right. I will go with Day of the Doctor.
All right, that's our final verdict.
I'm sorry, Terrence.
Unanimous. Dix. Day of the Doctor. Sorry, Terrence Dix. That's our show. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed it, please tell all of your nerdy friends, or better yet, write a review on our iTunes page. It helps. Join us next time when we'll be discussing Joshua's first ever Doctor Who story, Vengeance on Veros.
Wow.
Yes. and pitting the 11th Doctor TV story, Nightmare in Silver, against the 8th Doctor Big Finish audio, The Silver Turk. Until then, this is Pat.
I'm Kelvin.
And Joshua saying,
get off my world!
Well, I'm going to use the bathroom.
Use the bathroom.
And I'm going to come out, and we're going to have a topic.
If we don't have... Yeah, peeing is a great way to come up with an idea, in my experience.